Imagine a book written in 1999. I mean, we were talking way before social media, before the modern internet.
Right, long before anyone was arguing over TikTok algorithms or, global supply chain decoupling.
Exactly. Yet this totally obscure text somehow perfectly predicts the exact blueprint of today's semiconductor bans, financial sanctions, and cyber wars.
It really does read like a playbook for the 2020s. And it was published when most people were still using dial-up modems.
Welcome to today's deep dive. Whether you are prepping for a national security meeting, catching up on international relations, or, you're just insanely curious about how modern global power actually works, you are in the right place.
Absolutely.
Today, our mission is to analyze a massive stack of research and reports on a highly controversial book published by two Chinese Air Force officers. It's called Unrestricted Warfare, or in Chinese, Jiaxianzan.
And we're going to separate the factual systemic logic of this book from the prevailing myth. The myth that it serves as some sort of authenticated secret master plan governing every single move of the Chinese government. The goal is to look at the text, decode how the logic functions, and we'll understand why it has become such a lightning rod in policy circles.
Okay, let's unpack this because the central paradox is just wild. How did two mid-level officers see the future of global competition so clearly?
It's a great question.
To answer that, we really have to look at the sheer geopolitical panic of the 1990s. There were two massive paradigm-shattering shocks that completely broke the traditional understanding of warfare.
Yeah, the first catalyst was the 1991 Gulf War. For decades, military strategy was largely based on industrial mass.
Meaning just having more stuff.
Exactly. If you had more tanks, more artillery, and more infantry, you basically held the advantage. And the Chinese People's Liberation Army, the PLA, had built a massive ground-centric force based on that exact logic.
Then 1991 happens. The United States goes into Iraq, which at the time had one of the largest heavily mechanized armies on the entire planet.
Right.
And the U.S. just completely dismantles them in a matter of hours. But the critical takeaway for the authors, Qi Liang and Wang Shangsui, wasn't just that America won, it was how America won.
Yeah, they realized the U.S. had introduced a totally new paradigm, networked precision strike warfare.
Oh, wow.
The Americans were using space-enabled navigation, satellite uplinks, electronic warfare to blind Iraqi radar, and of course, stealth technology.
Right.
The PLA watched this and realized their millions of troops were essentially obsolete overnight. You simply cannot fight that kind of force head-on.
It's basically the realization that bringing a massive army to fight a networked invisible force is like bringing a heavy broadsword to a drone fight.
That is a perfect way to put it.
Swinging harder just won't help. You have to change the game entirely.
What's fascinating here is how these two authors took that realization and turned the U.S. military's own philosophy against itself. Well, at the time, the Pentagon was completely obsessed with its revolution in military affairs, or RMA. They were focusing entirely on maximizing high-tech weapons on a traditional battlefield.
Okay.
But Kao and Wang looked at that American dominance and spotted the Achilles heel.
The dependencies.
Yes, exactly. To make all those smart bombs and stealth fighters actually work, the U.S. had to build highly integrated, complex systems: satellites, GPS, global logistics supply chains, communication nodes.
So they saw the weak point.
Right. The authors posited a brilliant inversion. If an adversary's strength relies entirely on a complex network, you don't attack the fighter jet. You attack the network it relies on.
So the U.S. proved you couldn't beat them on a physical battlefield. But right around the same time, Kiao and Wang watched an entirely different kind of battlefield open up.
Yeah.
One where countries were being destroyed without a single bomb being dropped. Which brings us to the second shock, the 1997 to 1998 Asian financial crisis.
Right. While military strategists were busy studying smart bombs, our authors were watching capital flows. They saw currency expectations and investor panic trigger the collapse of entire national economies.
It's crazy.
In countries like Thailand and Indonesia, governments were literally toppling and generational wealth was vanishing overnight.
The mechanism there is terrifying when you think about it as a weapon.
It really is.
You have foreign investors rapidly pulling their capital out of a country, causing the local currency to just free fall. Suddenly, that country can't afford to import food or fuel.
Yeah.
The societal devastation looks identical to the aftermath of a bombing campaign, but the weapon was just financial speculation.
And that observation fundamentally changed their definition of a weapon. They argued that if a financial panic or, say, a cyber attack on a power grid can produce the same strategic capitulation as a military invasion, then the boundaries of what constitutes warfare have to expand.
Meaning weaker powers need to look elsewhere.
Exactly. A weaker power should shift the competition into these non-military domains where the stronger power is heavily exposed.
Okay, so if the core argument is simply about targeting an opponent's economic or digital dependencies, how did the West translate this into a terrifying, lawless doctrine where supposedly anything goes?
Well, it largely comes down to a significant semantic gap in translation.
Really? A translation issue?
Yeah. The English title, Unrestricted Warfare, carries a very specific, highly aggressive connotation. In Western military thought, unrestricted sounds like an amoral purge.
Right.
It implies zero rules, no ethics, and infinite, indiscriminate destruction.
But the original Chinese characters, Toxi and Zan, don't actually mean unrestricted in that lawless sense, do they?
They don't. Chao means to transcend or go beyond, and Zabian means limit or boundary. So a much more accurate translation is boundary-transcending warfare.
Oh, that makes a lot more sense.
The philosophy is about moving across inherited conceptual limits, not erasing the concept of limits entirely.
Wait, I have to push back on that a bit. The sources we are looking at explicitly point out that the book lists things like terrorism, smuggling, and ecological destruction as viable forms of warfare.
Right, they do.
So if you are advocating for ecological destruction, how does that not literally mean anything goes?
It's a very valid challenge. And honestly, it's exactly why the book triggers so much alarm in the West. The authors absolutely explore extreme methods.
Right.
But to understand how they expect this theory to be applied, you have to look at the internal restraints they build into the doctrine. Specifically, this is in the book's 8th chapter.
Okay, what kind of restraints?
They introduce principles like limited objectives and minimum consumption.
So how does an authoritarian system define minimum consumption when they are actively discussing things like smuggling or network attacks? I mean, minimum is a pretty subjective word.
Well, the authors define minimum strategically. The goal is to use the exact minimum amount of force or disruption necessary to cross a threshold of strategic effect, and no more than that.
Can you give an example?
Sure. If you want to force a neighboring country to concede a trade dispute, you don't destroy their entire power grid and plunge them into the Dark Ages.
Right, because that invites a massive military retaliation.
Exactly. Instead, you might just temporarily disrupt the port software they use to export their most valuable commodity.
Ah, okay, so it's all about calibration.
Yes. If we connect this to the bigger picture, transcending boundaries really means breaking bureaucratic walls. It means breaking the wall that separates, say, a finance ministry from a military command.
Okay, I see.
It does not mean universally abandoning all ethics to wage infinite war. In fact, they explicitly state in the text that limitless transcendence is an impossibility that would eventually destroy the user as well.
That calibration leads us to the core mechanism of the book. If the objective isn't total destruction, how do you actually win?
Right.
You win by mixing instruments of statecraft that were never historically meant to be mixed. The book calls this the concept of combinations.
And the authors break these combinations down into 4 specific boundaries you have to cross to be successful.
Let's walk through these, because this is where the 1999 predictions start sounding exactly like today's news. First, they outline the supranational boundary.
Right.
This is where you mix traditional state power with non-state actors. So instead of just sending in government operatives, a state might subtly back a decentralized group of hacktivists or even use massive multinational corporations to advance a geopolitical goal.
Yeah. And second is the super domain boundary. This is about mixing the military domain with these civilian, legal, or financial systems.
Like what?
Well, a prime example is using international law or environmental regulations to block an adversary's military expansion.
Wow. Okay. Third, we have super means, mixing lethal military force with non-lethal economic pressure.
Exactly.
Like, you might stage a massive military exercise on a border, not to actually invade, but to cause foreign investors to panic and pull their money out of your neighbor's economy.
And finally, the super tier boundary. This is where a deeply localized tactical action is designed to trigger a massive global systemic shock.
Oh, right.
Think of cutting a specific undersea fiber optic cable. It's a tiny, highly local action, but it instantly severs billions of dollars in global financial transactions.
The sources compare this combinatorial logic to a bartender mixing a bizarre but incredibly potent cocktail.
I love that analogy.
Right. None of the individual ingredients are particularly new. Tariffs, legal disputes, civilian protests, they have all existed forever.
Yeah.
But pouring them all into the exact same glass simultaneously is what creates a paralyzing effect.
Let's apply that cocktail to a real-world scenario from the research to see the mechanics in action. Take maritime coercion, specifically in places like the South China Sea.
Okay, let's hear it.
Imagine a state wants to alter the status quo and take control of a disputed island or reef. The traditional approach is simple. You send in naval warships, plant a flag, and dare the other side to shoot.
But that crosses the threshold into a shooting war, which violates the principle of minimum consumption.
Exactly. So, in a boundary-transcending scenario, the naval warships stay hidden way over the horizon.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, you start by mixing ingredients. First, the superdomain.
Okay.
You pass domestic administrative laws claiming sovereignty over the water, shaping the legal narrative.
Then you cross the supranational boundary. You deploy massive fleets of civilian fishing vessels to the area.
Right.
You just completely overwhelm the physical space with commercial boats, changing the facts on the ground.
Then you back those civilian boats up with heavily armed Coast Guard vessels.
Right.
Technically, they are law enforcement, not military.
Right. A key distinction.
So if the opposing nation tries to arrest your fishermen, your Coast Guard intervenes under the guise of protecting citizens.
Meanwhile, you are applying economic pressure. Maybe you suddenly find, quote unquote, health violations in the agricultural exports of the opposing nation and block them from your domestic market.
Yeah, exactly.
You are squeezing them legally, economically, and physically with civilian boats. And your actual warships are just sitting miles away, acting as a silent deterrent.
The beauty of the cocktail is that no single instrument justifies the opponent starting a war. A fishing boat isn't an act of war. A trade dispute isn't an act of war.
No, it's not.
But the combined, integrated effect successfully changes the reality of who actually controls the island. The military is no longer the tip of the spear. It is merely the backup holding the space while the non-military means do the actual conquering.
We've seen how this works in the physical world, but the domains where this combinatorial logic is most devastating today are the ones we all rely on every day. Your wallet and your tech.
Absolutely. Financial networks are the ultimate example of modern strategic infrastructure. If we go back 100 years, infrastructure was a bridge, a rail line, or a port.
Right.
Today, the most critical infrastructure is the U.S. dollar, the SWIFT messaging system, and the network of global correspondent banks.
Let's break down the mechanism there, because people hear SWIFT and they just think it's the app their bank uses to wire money abroad. How does a wire transfer become a weapon?
Well, power derives from network centrality. Let's look at the plumbing of the global economy, because a massive share of global trade, like oil, commodities, cross-border investments, is priced in U.S. dollars.
Okay.
Those transactions eventually have to clear through a U.S.-linked correspondent bank or a clearinghouse based in New York.
So even if a bank in Asia is sending money to a bank in South America, if it's in dollars, it physically touches the U.S. financial system.
Yes. And that gives the jurisdiction controlling those networks immense leverage. It creates a massive global choke point. The sources point to the 2022 sanctions on Russia following the invasion of Ukraine as the starkest example of this.
Right. The financial response was huge.
A coalition of nations didn't just sanction oligarchs. They went after the Russian central bank itself.
They completely restricted Russia's ability to access and deploy its own sovereign reserves held in foreign currencies.
It demonstrated to the entire world that sovereign assets carry severe geopolitical risk. You don't need to bomb a country's treasury if you can simply flip a switch in a clearinghouse and freeze their ability to participate in the global economy.
It is the ultimate supra means combination.
It really is.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because the exact same choke point logic is now being applied to technology.
Yeah.
The sources highlight two massive developments on this front. First, the 2025 BIS export controls.
Right.
For context, the BIS is the Bureau of Industry and Security. They are basically the arm of the U.S. Commerce Department that polices what critical technology is allowed to leave the country.
And the U.S. recognized that while they might not manufacture every single microchip, they control the indispensable bottlenecks in the supply chain.
Like what?
Things like the advanced software used to design the chips, or the highly specialized machines required to physically print them.
So the U.S. used those choke points to effectively wall off advanced computing and semiconductor capabilities from competitors, framing it explicitly as a national security measure.
Exactly.
But this is an interactive system, right? I mean, the opponent doesn't just sit there.
Which brings us to the reciprocal leverage. The sources cite a 2026 assessment by CSIS, the Center for Strategic and International Studies. They are a major think tank in Washington.
Okay.
They analyzed how China restricted the export of dual-use critical minerals to Japan. These are the raw materials essential for everything from electric vehicle batteries to advanced radar systems.
So both sides are mixing the exact same cocktail. They are using domestic industrial policy, control over critical minerals, and choke points in microchip manufacturing to achieve a strategic objective.
Yeah, degrading the other side's long-term capability to compete.
It is modern statecraft adopting the precise blueprint laid out in 1999.
It really is striking.
So, if this boundary-transcending cocktail is so incredibly powerful, if states can wage this invisible war through clearinghouses and supply chains, is every single action a rival state takes a flawlessly executed piece of unrestricted warfare?
That's the big question.
Because you read the news, and it feels like every new bridge being built, every tariff, every single app is labeled by pundits as part of this grand, sinister master plan.
This is where we need a serious reality check. The research explicitly warns against what it calls analytical inflation.
Okay, unpack that.
First, we had to look at the doctrinal authority of the book itself. Unrestricted Warfare was published by the PLA Literature and Arts Publishing House.
The Arts Publishing House? I mean, that's like a military thought experiment being published by a university press, not a classified Pentagon war manual.
Exactly. It was a conceptual experiment by two serving officers. Yeah. It was not, and still is not, an authenticated operational manual endorsed by the Central Military Commission.
So what does this all mean when a listener sees massive sprawling projects like China's Belt and Road Initiative, funding ports and railways across the globe, constantly labeled as unrestricted warfare?
The listener really needs to understand that correlation is not causation.
Right.
Just because a policy resembles the logic of the book, like using economic means for strategic ends, does not mean the policy was birthed by this specific 1999 document.
Makes sense.
Furthermore, labeling everything as a flawless execution of a master plan falls into the omnipotent strategist fallacy.
That's the assumption that the opposing government is a perfectly unified, brilliant machine that literally never makes a mistake.
Exactly, which we know for a fact is false. Governments are messy. The book assumes that coordinating all these different domains is straightforward. But in reality, bureaucratic friction is a massive hurdle.
Walk us through that friction. Why is it so hard to mix the cocktail in real life?
Imagine trying to execute a super domain strategy. You have a central bank whose primary mandate is global financial stability.
Right.
You have a foreign ministry that just wants to ensure a smooth upcoming diplomatic summit.
Yeah, right.
And you have a security agency that wants to apply maximum cyber pressure on a rival.
Ah, okay.
These agencies have differing legal authorities, competing budgets, and completely different risk tolerances.
So getting them to flawlessly synchronize a cyber attack with a currency devaluation and a diplomatic narrative is like trying to get five different corporate departments to agree on a catering order, but with the fate of the global economy on the line.
That is exactly it. This raises an important question. How much of what commentators breathlessly call unrestricted warfare is actually just modern, messy, everyday statecraft?
That's a great point.
Using economic coercion or diplomatic pressure isn't new. The domains have expanded into cyber and space, sure, but attributing every geopolitical friction to a secret doctrine ignores the chaotic reality of how hard it is to actually govern.
That is such a vital distinction to make. To quickly recap for you listening, the true genius of unrestricted warfare wasn't that it offered a literal step-by-step blueprint for a government to perfectly execute today.
No, not at all.
Its genius was that it successfully saw through the fog of the 1990s and predicted the future. It saw that the battlefield was going to expand far beyond the geographic map.
Yeah.
It predicted that the systems we rely on daily, our banking clearinghouses, our critical minerals, our tech supply chains, were going to become the primary terrain of 21st century competition.
It essentially provided a vocabulary for the boundary-transcending world we were about to enter.
But there is one final lingering thought from the sources that we have to talk about. It's a brief but incredibly weighty mention regarding the shift in the 2020s toward artificial intelligence and what military strategists call decision-tempo competition.
Right. We just discussed how human bureaucratic friction, like departmental rivalries, legal hesitation, the sheer messiness of human coordination, is the primary bottleneck preventing the perfect execution of this combination of all means.
The human element is what keeps the cocktail from being mixed perfectly every single time.
Exactly. So, consider the implications in the very near future when autonomous AI agents are introduced into this framework.
Oh, wow.
AI does not suffer from interagency rivalries. It doesn't worry about its budget or hesitate over a legal memo.
What happens when an AI system is given the reins to instantly coordinate cyber intrusions, algorithmic financial market manipulation, and targeted cognitive information campaigns across all domains, simultaneously and flawlessly?
It takes that theoretical cocktail from 1999 and mixes it at a speed and scale that humans cannot even perceive, let alone react to. If the limitation of unrestricted warfare was always the friction of human bureaucracy, AI removes the friction entirely.
The map with no borders suddenly becomes a map where the attacks happen everywhere all at once. And that is a chilling thought to mull over. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the boundaries of the information you consume, and remember, the chessboard is always much bigger than it looks. We'll see you next time.